Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
Happy Friday. This is The Takeaway for October 21st, 2016. Remember to keep the conversation going on our Facebook page at The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And let's try on this Friday to settle all the rigged election business that we've heard in this campaign. Could we?
I come from Africa, where we have rigged election, people kill each other. And when we look at United States election, and we see after the election, somebody saying to his opponent, congratulations, is something good for us. I'm not saying America democracy is great, is perfect, but when we look into that and we see in different countries people killing each other for rigged election, and I heard some people giving into that rhetoric of Donald Trump, that's sad for me, for real, because we'll look at America as a model for democracy.
That's 33-year-old Lassina Kone from the troubled African nation of Ivory Coast expressing outrage over Donald Trump's hinting with a sledgehammer in Wednesday's televised debate that he would, quote, keep us in suspense about accepting the outcome of November's election. The charge of rigging and manipulation is one Trump has repeatedly made throughout the campaign. And it was a joke last night at the traditional Al Smith dinner.
It's amazing I'm up here after Donald. I didn't think he'd be okay with a peaceful transition of power. You know, I've had the privilege of being at the Al Smith dinners in years past, and I always enjoy it. But remember, if you're not happy with the way it comes out, it must be rigged.
But there's nothing funny about talk of rigged elections and the behavior on the part of politicians that encourages cynicism and potentially erodes the precious trust that makes democracies work. Michelle Dunn is director and senior associate of the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
In a country like the United States, where you have two strong political parties, they really keep an eye on each other, right? And one is definitely going to call out abuses by the other. In a lot of other countries where you don't have that, then there's nobody to do it. If there's no independent electoral commission, if there's no strong civil society, if there are no strong political parties, then there isn't anybody there. You know, one of the ways that countries in the Middle East nowadays are controlling the outcome of elections is by controlling the candidates, just controlling who gets to run and excluding candidates. And a lot of countries, Iran, for example, it has this guardian council, this clerical body that excludes large numbers of candidates and candidates who have a real chance of winning elections for all kinds of reasons. So this is another thing that a lot of countries are doing nowadays so that the process looks clean on election day, but in effect, they've controlled the outcome in advance. You can't have this happen as easily in a country where you have vigorous political parties and you have a primary system and all of that.
Speak to the issue of trust, because ultimately what is the fuel of democracy that really runs the entire system is a sense of trust by the electorate that the system works and that their vote is expressed in some way. Whether we're talking about the United States and Donald Trump or places that you've studied around the world, if that trust starts to erode, you've got real problems. And that can happen whether there is real intimidation or not. It's about the perception of the voters.
Yeah, that's true. I think what's incredibly important is that going into elections that voters and candidates and political parties believe that even if they lose this election, there's going to be another day. There's going to be another chance, right, in 2 years or 4 years or whenever, you know, whenever the next elections come, they believe that the process goes on, that the process has integrity no matter who wins this time around. And that's what keeps the process peaceful, you know, that people don't need to resort in violence. As I've seen in the Middle East, especially since the Arab Spring, there were really some difficult elections where people didn't yet have any confidence in the process, and therefore there was this sort of zero sum thinking, right? I have to win, and I have to eliminate the others because I don't know whether there will be any chance. And also, you know, people fearing that if they lost the elections, they'd end up in jail, because this has happened to a lot of people in the Middle East. I mean, I think that was incredibly damaging, having Donald Trump say that Hillary Clinton would be in jail if he won, because it really evokes what happens in other parts of the world. And it's really been unfortunate, because there are a lot of undemocratic powers in the world today, and Russia kind of leads the pack here, that are trying assiduously to undermine confidence in democratic processes, whether in Europe or the United States, and cast aspersions on our systems and undermine confidence on the part of our voters and lead them around to the idea that, you know, maybe they'd be just as well off with a sort of authoritarian system such as Russia has right now.
Would you say that trust in the institutions of electoral democracy are easier to erode, that trust is easier to erode than it is to restore?
It's easy to erode partly because of the openness of our media, and it makes the transparency of our society and so forth. It makes it easier for outsiders to come in and do that kind of thing. I think, you know, Americans are aware, and they should be aware, that there are imperfections in our system and that there are abuses at time, and they need to be addressed. And that's totally legitimate. But there's a world of difference between that and a system that is essentially rigged and in which there's no real recourse. You know, I think it's important for people to keep in mind, even though we have abuses of our democratic system, even though we have human rights abuses and so forth in the United States, there are ways to redress them. And that's what makes a democracy so different from an autocracy, for example.
Michelle Dunn is director and senior associate of the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Michelle Dunn, thank you so much.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Here's a story of how the aftershocks of the 2016 presidential race are having an impact in seemingly safe congressional districts, where intensive gerrymandering has turned incumbency into a suit of armor. But that armor is cracking in the suddenly fascinating 49th district in California, where Republican Congressman Daryl Issa is facing the toughest reelection campaign in his 15 years in office. Democrat Doug Applegate, a former Marine colonel and Iraq War veteran, drew surprisingly strong support during primaries in June. Now the candidates are polling just 4 points apart, with Applegate in the lead. Steve Walsh is a reporter for KPBS in San Diego, and he says that Applegate's mere presence as an alternative to the conservative Issa in the home of Marine Camp Pendleton is proving decisive in this Trump-weary district.
He did basically nothing. He'll admit, and in fact, Daryl Issa will also admit, that they did very little campaigning during the primary, so it becomes kind of a litmus test for where the voters are. And what Doug Applegate believes is that Issa's close association with Donald Trump, the fact that he gave him his full-throated endorsement when Donald Trump came to San Diego in May, that helped pull down his vote total.
And people feel as though Trump is not a sort of an appropriate voice to have in Congress, even though Issa has been very, very successful there.
Issa has been very successful. Trump, though, is, trailing Hillary Clinton in California, I think, by the last poll by 26 points. So he is way down there. And also, during the primary, you had a lot of very energized Democrats. You had more Democrats come out to vote in the primary than they typically do, with Clinton and Sanders still in a race for president. There was also a high-profile Senate seat, open seat for Senator Barbara Boxer. So there are a lot of reasons for Democrats to come to the polls. And at the same time, the demographics of Darrell Issa's district are beginning to change. Republicans still hold an 8% advantage in that district, but it's been shrinking over the years. And that the people that are becoming registered in that district are both younger and Latino, two demographics that do not perform well for either Donald Trump or Darrell Issa.
Does Doug Applegate have the stature to be a statewide candidate? Is he someone who's going to really sort of stand out in the election returns on November 8th?
It is certainly one of the races we're watching. This is the first time he has ever run. And he's kind of a tailor-made Democrat for this district, considering that he is a retired Marine colonel right in the middle of this district, which is straddles both San Diego County and Orange County, is Camp Pendleton, a very large Marine base with just not a bunch of active-duty Marines, but a lot of retired Marines. Applegate is getting a lot of help. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has put in about $2 million into this campaign, hoping to flip this district. In fact, it's one of the districts they're hoping to flip nationwide.
And they could flip it on this issue of veterans, because the shift between thinking about national security as the major concern over enemies like ISIS versus the needs of veterans that are multiplying since the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, you suddenly have almost a social issue, a entitlement issue with veterans issues that trumps the traditional sort of military voter.
I suppose so. So you've got a Republican in Darrell Issa that's always been focused on these national issues. He did the initial hearings into Benghazi, the Fast and Furious, the gun buying program. And now, yes, this election seems to have drawn him more closely toward his district. And he's put out, the first yard signs he's ever had to put out in the 16 years since he's been in office. So, yeah, I think people are starting to turn a little more closer to home in this district.
A lot of outside money here.
A lot of outside money. In fact, Doug Applegate, when I've talked to him, he's come back from Washington, come back from Seattle. A lot of that is just pure fundraising. And apparently, nationally, Darrell Issa is the sort of name that makes it easier for a Democrat to fundraise.
Well, if the returns aren't terribly exciting on November 8th, looking at what's going on in the California 49th District might just be the most interesting political development of this 2016 election. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks a lot.
Steve Walsh is a reporter for KPBS in San Diego.
Your Honors, in this venue, I announce my separation from the United States.
That's Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte announcing a separation from the U.S. and an alignment with his, quote, blood brother Xi Jinping, the president of China. Duterte has been in Beijing on a four-day official visit to the country, which concludes today. America has lost, Duterte said, and a new Eastern alliance with Russia is on the horizon.
There are three of us against the world: China, Philippines, and Russia. It's the only way.
Philippine officials are now busily trying to explain Duterte's separation comment, saying the Philippines will maintain trade and economic ties with the U.S. Barbara Demick has been following the story for the Los Angeles Times. What are we to make of Duterte's comments?
Well, thank you very much. I mean, as you heard, President Duterte was speaking in English, and he sounded, you know, quite emphatic, very unequivocal. You know, at the same time, the people in his cabinet are starting to walk away from these statements. The trade minister said today, oh, he didn't mean separation. It's a rebalance. It's quite a confusing situation. Something you might have noticed in the statement, he said, I announce my separation. Mm. And, you know, who is he speaking for? I think you can expect a lot of climbing back from this statement.
Is this a development in Asia that China and Russia would welcome and have yearned for decades? Or is Duterte something of a Hugo Chavez character, and that he speaks big, but is something of a liability ultimately?
Well, that's exactly the case. Others have compared him to Chavez. You know, he has a very machismo style of speaking, and you know, goes beyond his mandate. I think the Chinese were stunned. You know, they knew he was drifting away from the U.S. He was very upset about U.S. criticism of his war on drugs. I mean, this is
He basically allows vigilantism in the Philippines.
Yeah,
people can go out and take their own revenge on drug lords.
Exactly. And there's some 3,500 people who have been killed since Duterte was elected.
No, people are turning themselves in. They're so terrified to be on the street.
Yeah, and some of them have turned themselves in and gotten executed anyway.
Right.
So the U.S. has been criticizing this. And, you know, China doesn't really poke its nose into other people's human rights. Rights matters. And Duterte had some very choice words that I can't repeat on air about Obama after Obama criticized the war on drugs. So he was leaning towards the Chinese. But as I said, I think they were stunned. And I think the Russians were stunned. I saw some funny quotes from the Russian ambassador to Manila this morning saying, oh, well, whatever they want, we'll give them. Now, the Russians don't have that much money to invest in foreign aid. The Chinese certainly do.
There is a dispute between the Philippines and China in the South China Sea in territorial terms that could erupt. Does this rhetoric settle that or make that easier to deal with or just render it moot?
You know, it's interesting that Duterte also said, let's negotiate directly.
Mm-hmm.
And his predecessors didn't want to be engaged in direct negotiations with the Chinese. Actually, things were going very well for the Philippines. The Philippines basically won a ruling in The Hague over the summer.
Right.
You know, the Chinese were saying, you know, basically all this South China Sea is ours because of old maps. And The Hague said they did not have a historical claim.
So potentially the Chinese might think that there would be some sort of deal made that Duterte would revert fishing rights back to the Chinese, which, again, would raise all kinds of questions in Asia that would worry the United States. But again, all those are question marks right now.
They are. And it's, you know, it's interesting. Duterte apparently did not get a deal that would allow Philippine fishermen to continue using these waters. Filipinos are quite anti-Chinese. And for the last few years, Chinese fishing boats and also, you know, Chinese maritime boats have been chasing away Philippine fishermen from these waters that they fished for centuries. I was in some of these villages a few years ago, and the Filipinos are quite upset about that. And I don't think that Duterte is coming back from Beijing with any kind of deal with the Chinese.
And this is not a populist issue. You know, the Chinese are our blood brothers that the Philippines are likely to get excited about in any way.
No, in fact, they're not. Duterte's war on drugs has been very popular, and his popularity is high. The Filipinos are very pro-American, and I think the latest Pew polls showed something like 97% having a favorable view of the United States. I mean, that's like almost the highest in the world, and they do not like the Chinese. And so I think he's going beyond. And also, this is a country where people have fought hard for democracy. I don't think they're willing to embrace Putin and Xi Jinping so readily.
Barbara Demick is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Please, fast, your position, please. Your position.
AP-52. We have small children. Please, can you have a break?
Okay, how many people on board?
I think it's about 150 people.
100.
Sometimes the power of documentary filmmaking can make you weak with a kind of humility that only comes from bearing witness to powerful human experiences.
Okay.
And we have most of them is women and kids. Please, can you help us very quickly? Yeah, we are thinking. We are staying here in the same coordination. We will not move.
That's a call on a radio in the dark. There's really no picture, just the sound of a voice on a boat somewhere in the Mediterranean pleading for help.
The same coordination. We will not move.
Madam, please. calm down, because we will send rescue, but you need to calm down. Okay, so save your battery. I will call you back.
This is a scene from the film Fire at Sea, shot from the bridge of an Italian Navy vessel in the middle of the crisis of migrants that has seen over 1 million people, mostly fleeing Syria and Iraq, crossing the Mediterranean last year, the majority of them making the trip across the Aegean Sea to crowded refugee camps in Greece. Or they're attempting to cross the Mediterranean from Libya into Italy. Either way, it's a deadly journey across the perilous distance from certain death to potential death. This year, more than 3,173 migrants have rolled the dice and lost, died. The number of fatalities up 14% from 2015, according to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Gianfranco Rossi is the director of this film. For a year and a half, he lived in Lampedusa, a small Italian island in the Mediterranean just north of the Libyan coast. He lived on board Italian warships, responding to distress calls from wooden boats full of migrants, hoping for a new life in Europe.
It was important because Lampedusa has been on the edge of news and media for years, but always linked to certain tragedy, unfortunately, death of migrants, and it became like somehow a sort of container of tragic story. And every time it was somehow left out, the fact that in this island there live some people. So for me, it was necessary to somehow change the point of view. There was this need of somehow get it deeper inside the story of the people living there.
There are many moments like this. I mean, here's one in particular, which gives you a sense of people so close to each other calling on for help, and yet the help impossible to be delivered.
How many people?
Please.
How many people?
250.
Your position.
There is in danger. Please, you beg, you please save us.
Your position.
In the name of God.
Your position.
Yeah, our position. One, please.
Your position.
We are in the Mediterranean. We are in the Mediterranean. Please.
Your
position. Please, we beg you.
Your position. My friend. Hello? Hello?
What were you feeling?
It's what I feel exactly now, a sense of impotence mostly, because these voices, this cry for help, they happen every day constantly. There are these boats, they live from Libya in very, very desperate condition. These boats are not able to cross the sea, and most of that time they sink after 2-3 hours of navigation. So more than 20,000 people die in the last 15 years, tried to cross Libya to arrive to Lampedusa to reach freedom. And this is one of the biggest tragedy Europe is facing. And when I hear this sound, you know, there is so much desperation in those voices. And this, unfortunately, was these people, they were never found. They
never really, found.
They were never found, yeah.
So that voice, also the voice, that voice of the is other, the last...
The last...
significance of...
The last sight of life, you
right.
know.
His,
I was witnessing this for 40 days, every day. One day we did more than 2,000 rescue in one single day from the military boat. 2,000 people that were brought alive in the thing. And then one day, unfortunately, I encountered death, and death came to me. I didn't want to film death. I always avoided to film death in my film because I know how big right. responsibility is to put your camera on someone that is a dead body. And that day I met death, and I met, unfortunately, 50 people that died under the boat. And I went down there to film that scene, and it was very difficult. I had the support of the commander of the Navy that he told me it's your responsibility to film that. This is like being in front of a chamber gas and not filming because it's too harsh. You have to show this to the world, and I forced myself to go down there, and I filmed that 30-second that appeared in the film. And so then the whole film was somehow to build in order to show mm-hmm. this tragedy, and not only to arrive there and show the death, but also to be able to go out of that and give somehow dignity also to the people that I was filming in Lampedusa.
One of the biggest steps in that journey is the step that each one of those migrants takes to get in one of those boats, knowing from the reports now that, you know, you might never survive. Could you imagine what it was like? Could you imagine yourself getting into one of the boats that you saw in those 40 days?
You know, when I asked them, what made you do this? What make you cross the sea in this condition when you know you might die? That's what my question was. And he told me, it's the word might, because If we stay in Libya, we will die for sure. So it's that desperation of escaping the fire somehow, you know, escaping the, when people, they have the fire, they jump the window, and then no matter what, they have to, instead of getting burned, they have to jump towards towards something, and that's what they do, they jump into the sea. That's what the man says, jumping into the water, you know. And sometimes they made it, sometimes they don't make it. But that's what he told me, in Libya we will die no matter what. And there we have the hope. And we are here now, we made it. And we are in Lampedusa, we reached freedom. And this is again the duty of our country, of Europe, of not betraying the hope of these people that arrived and they finally reached a dream of freedom. And most of the time we are not able to fulfill this hope and this dream. And we say, we don't want you here. Please go back to your country. After the years of journey, money they spend, and they arrive to touch a land of freedom, and then feeling that the people, they don't want them, and, you know, building walls.
We're all in that.
You know, when Obama, Barack Obama made his speech at the United Nations a few weeks ago on the migrant crisis, he said something very, very strong. He said, if we build a barrier, if we build a wall, we create a prison for ourselves. And that's what we have to understand, you know, that wall never resists history.
Gianfranco Rossi, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
This week, culture reporter Melissa Locker and I had to have some straight talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's a dodgy concept for both of us, but in our own ways, we've grown to appreciate the Hall and its yearly nominations. It's a bit of a shock to learn that Tupac Shakur is on the list for the very first time this year. And in a month when Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, Locker says the Hall of Fame needs to stick to its mission of representing the broadest range of artists and genres, a list that could use some work, she says, when it comes to gender.
I think there's only about 44 women who have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is crazy talk. But this year we have three women who are nominated, and I think that is a, you know, decent place to start, although the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has a lot of catching up to do. My personal vote this year, and I think the internet agrees with me, is Janet Jackson. Cause prophecy is my middle name, my last name is Control. No, my first name ain't baby, it's Janet, Miss Jackson if you're nasty. So this year is kind of a very mixed bag, which I think actually really is representative of the state of rock and roll these days. You have bands like Pearl Jam, and what I'm going to go ahead and say is one of the most important bands out of Washington, D.C., Bad Brains. I think they really live up to all the qualifications that a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee is supposed to have. They're really influential, had really an important sound. They're amazing, and the fact that they finally got nominated is great. My other personal favorite that I'm heavily rooting for is Depeche Mode. The chances of them getting in, not necessarily
Why?
The greatest.
I mean,
but
it seems like they're a natural. I mean, they had such a distinctive sound.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. But they, you know, they're going up against people like Pearl Jam and Jane's Addiction and Bad Brains and Joan Baez, who should totally be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame already. And the fact that she's not is completely crazy. I mean, if Bob Dylan can get a Nobel Prize, Joan Baez deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She is wildly influential. She had, you know, incredible.
Influenced Dylan.
Yeah. She was right there at the heart of it all while, you know, rock and roll was happening around her. People are going to be surprised that bands like Journey or The Zombies aren't already in the Rock Hall.
I know. I am surprised by that.
Right. But, you know, Journey had, like, two really good songs. And I can't necessarily say they were wildly influential. I mean, they have one song that has, you know, influenced karaoke singers from coast to coast. But I don't know if that necessarily qualifies them. But there's also bands like the MC5 who were, you know, right in the heart of rock and roll out of Detroit. They were right there with the Stooges and the whole punk scene as it was exploding. And they're definitely influential.
Back in the 70s, I have to say, I have to disclose this, I was someone who listened to Yes a lot.
I'm not sure that surprises me.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. They're nominated. Mm-hmm. You think they'll get in? Eventually.
Yes? That was terrible. I'm sorry. I feel like they're one of those bands that will eventually get in because there were a lot of guys in the 70s listening to Yes. I was probably more the type of person who's going to be listening to Chaka Khan and Janet Jackson and Joan Baez, but that's me.
The Cars were, you know, also a New York scene band.
they were kind of like one of the first bands to really kind of cross over into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. They had some massive hits, and they're still out there. They put out a box set earlier this year, which I believe I actually touted on this radio program. And I think that their influence is hard to deny. But, you know, I never really know what's going on in the heads of the Rock Hall voters. But luckily this year and for the last couple of years, fans have been able to vote as well. Because you can go onto the Rock Hall website and you can write in your own nominee, and there's going to be a fan ballot, and people can, you know, go and say, heck yeah, we want En Vogue. Because why don't you want En Vogue in the Rock Hall of Fame? The one person who I really think everybody should write in this year is Grace Jones.
Oh.
The fact that she is not in the Rock Hall, and I don't even know she's ever been nominated, is completely crazy. So I want people to go to the Rock Hall website and start typing in Grace Jones. It's an easy name to remember, and she absolutely deserves to be there.
You could make this happen.
It is my number one goal in life.
This week.
This week.
Melissa Locker, reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway on all things culture. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, my God! Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. It's our Friday movie conversation. It's great to have you here.
Hi, John.
So I actually was a big fan of the Jack Reacher first movie that everyone forgot. It was an interesting character for Tom Cruise. That's the big release, Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. What do you think?
Yeah, this is the sequel. You know, he's the ex-military loner created by the novelist Lee Child. And in this episode, one of his army buddies is brought up on espionage charges. She's played by Cobie Smulders, and he's going to break her out of a military prison and get to the bottom of this mystery.
Two things are going to happen in the next 90 seconds.
Excuse me?
First, that phone over there is going to ring. Second, you're going to be wearing these cuffs on your way to prison.
Well, that is one magnificent prophecy, Mr. Reacher.
You know, this plays to the Clint Eastwood qualities of Tom Cruise, whatever you may think of him. And I like that because Mission Impossible, he's just hanging out of buildings all the time.
You know, I happen to think that Tom Cruise is still today just a total bona fide movie star. And
yeah.
If there's a reason to see this movie, it's definitely him. I found him a little too smug and cocky and unbelievable in the first Jack Reacher. He's a little more vulnerable, a little angrier in this movie, which I kind of like.
Well, we'll see if it connects.
Yes, I think it probably will. You know, Tom Cruise is great in these kinds of roles.
This trailer has certainly connected. I've seen it about three or four times. The Keeping Up with the Joneses movie, which is the new comedy with John Hamm and Zach Galifianakis.
I said, get in the car.
We're going to get in the car.
Guys, now.
When I count to three, we're going to run, okay? One, two.
Jeff!
Oh, my God.
I said three!
Jeff! Please, would you just get in the car?
How was we going to head start?
On your wife?
How do you figure out who's the straight man or woman and who's the comedian in this film?
That's a good point. You forgot to mention Gal Gadot, who our future Wonder Woman is also in this film. You know, this seems to be kind of a holdover from sort of a late 70s, early 80s comedy genre. The suburban couple, new neighbors move in, and it turns out they're spies, and they get drawn into an espionage plot. I just don't feel like this film has its imagination working on overdrive quite enough. You know, and I just feel like in this day and age when it's so easy to stay on the couch and watch something on your TV, I feel like a comedy has got to give you a little bit more than this to really bring you out into the theaters. And it just, I can't say it's a bad movie. It's amiable. It's not offensive. I like that. It's good-natured, but it doesn't really hit you. There's not very many belly laughs in this one.
the inevitable Michael Moore lands in Trump land. And that literally is the movie that's released here in New York. Michael Moore in Trump land. What's it all about?
Surprise release. Announced Tuesday, started playing on Wednesday. It's a filmed version of his one-man stage show in Wilmington, Ohio, a Trump stronghold, where he basically goes and tries to sway the voters over toward Hillary Clinton. There is one moment in this film that I like where he seems to really genuinely reach across the proverbial aisle and try to connect and empathize with Trump voters, their anger, their sense of disenfranchisement. And I thought that was a really interesting and kind of moving little mini essay that he has in this film. But I have to tell you, this is basically an hour and 10 minutes of stumping for Hillary Clinton. And even if you are a diehard supporter, I'm not really sure you're going to buy some of Michael Moore's arguments, comparing Hillary Clinton to the Pope and fantasizing that she's going to have a first 100 days where she enacts all these daring pieces of legislation and completely changes the country. So in a way, it really just plays to the usual Michael Moore base. Even though I think he's talented, funny, he's a lot of fun to see on stage, no big surprises here. This is not what you'd call an October surprise, I guess.
Cashing in on the bizarre qualities of the 2016 election.
Yes, very much so.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You too, John.
The thing about immortals is they can't really have birthdays. But Wonder Woman, she's immortal, turns 75 today. The once Secretary of the Justice League, then full Justice League member, thank you very much, a TV show in the 70s. Today, Wonder Woman is the United Nations Honorary Ambassador for Empowerment of Women and Girls. There's even a movie in production. So when we thought about how to commemorate this moment, we discovered that our own Wonder Woman on the Takeaway staff, Isabel Angel, was dying to be the one to speak with Diane Nelson, the president of DC Entertainment, who is in New York today accepting Wonder Woman's official role as UN ambassador. Isabel?
I mean, where do I start? When I was little, and I'm, you know, I guess I'm not that old, but there weren't many women superheroes. We had Wonder Woman, but she didn't have her own movie like Spider-Man and Batman. But that didn't stop me back in the eighth grade from rocking a pair of Wonder Woman knee socks. I still have those in the back of my closet. And there was a little bit of that eighth grade me, totally excited self, when I sat down with Diane Nelson to learn all about Wonder Woman and what gives her that inner strength.
She meant empowerment then. She meant equality, peace. She's a warrior, but she's ultimately looking for love over violence. All the things that we would still aspire to, compassion, but willing to fight for what she believes in. And what we're celebrating today with the UN is all about their initiative to help get gender equality so that women around the world are given the same opportunities, whether it's with education or work or home. And certainly violence is a part of that.
I think that's something that's really interesting about Wonder Woman. It really appeals to me about her is that, you know, she is strong. She's a warrior, but she has great compassion. She's not just only tough lady, business all the time, mean, you know, kind of that when we think of you have to be strong, it's a man's world. You have to conform. You have to leave that part of your gender behind. She doesn't really do that, does she?
Right, not at all. And obviously, there have been many iterations of her story over time in the comics, in the original television show with Linda Carter, and an upcoming Patty Jenkins version of Wonder Woman, which comes out next year. It's what makes her so relevant now, whether it's women in business like ourselves or women dealing with life. You can argue that women bring a certain empathy and compassion to even the toughest situations. That's not to say that men don't as well, but I think it is an advantage. And again, Marsden recognized that from the outset, but it doesn't take away from her strength. I mean, when she's committed to something, I don't use the term warrior lightly. You know, she can be really kick-ass.
What do you think about Wonder Woman? Do you feel any sort of kinship with her?
I do. I talk about it all the time. I mean, I'm often asked who is my favorite female character in particular. And, you know, you could argue it's a little bit more controversial to say Harley Quinn, right? But Wonder Woman's always resonated for me. Maybe it's because I grew up watching the television show and that was kind of imprinted, you know, just her, everything was fabulous about her, not just her persona, but her gear and her bracelets and the spin and all those things that we still think of, frankly, because there hasn't been another visual representation outside of the comics for Wonder Woman. But the point you brought up earlier is certainly true for me, and I think for many women in business. I've had wonderful male and female mentors. I don't feel discriminated against, but I certainly like having an aspirational figure who I can look to and be reminded that it's okay to be compassionate. It's okay to care about people and to want peace and not look for conflict. And sometimes in our industry, there are a lot of people who like to look for conflict.
So when I was in eighth grade, I actually had a pair of Wonder Woman knee socks. And I just loved any story that I could get my hands on that had these, you know, strong, awesome female characters. Now we find ourselves in a time when we do have a lot of strong female characters. You know, we've got Katniss from The Hunger Games, Rey from Star Wars, Marvel's Black Widow, X-Men's got a bunch, Mystique, Storm probably missing some here. And I just would have been so excited to have this Wonder Woman movie. And I just think, like, how did this take so long?
Yeah. I don't have a good answer for that. I'm just really glad that there's an understanding of how much people want this, men and women. She will be an icon for young girls to feel like they can save the world for the first time. And we really haven't had that. And yet you had your knee socks and I had my bracelets, or I don't think I had underoos. I would probably had some version of it. But we were sort of scraping for some identity then, always knew we wanted it. And so, again, it's I'm just glad that we've come around to finally doing it and doing it really well.
Do you think Wonder Woman would be excited she's getting her first movie?
Oh, yeah. She'd say, what took you so long?
You know, we're going through this kind of tough election right now. It's been particularly tough on women. I think I could say, regardless of your political persuasion, it kind of makes me wish Wonder Woman were here to handle the situation. Do you think she'd have any wise words for us here?
She'd say, I look forward to our first female president in a few months.
Yeah, and she ran at one point, didn't she?
She did. She's had a very eclectic mix of political roles over the years, including Secretary General of the UN and some other kind of ironic things. But yes, she has done that. And, you know, leadership is a key part of what the UN initiative is all about for us, and what she's representing is this idea of equal representation of women in key leadership roles, whether that's in businesses or whether it's in government, that we're not truly going to have a full potential society globally until women are an equal part of that mix. And so I think that's probably what she'd be pushing for.
And I think I'd be remiss to not ask about Wonder Woman's outfit. So, you know, she for a while had the really kind of skimpy bathing suit thing from the 70s. Now it looks way tougher, with looks more like armor as opposed to fabric.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still kind of, you know, it's strapless. What do you think about this outfit? Do you think that in this day, you know, it's good for girls to look up to something like that in the UN? You know, if you're putting this out there for girls across the world, what are they seeing when they're seeing this outfit?
Right. It's a fair question. And I think the most important thing I'll go back to is that Wonder Woman is compelling and iconic because of the attributes she stands for, and less about her physical persona or the costumes she wears. You know, costumes are a colorful part of the history of comics, and fans are rabid about sticking with original costumes in some cases. But Wonder Woman's had a number of different costumes over the years, including pantsuits and something as recent as 2010. Jim Lee, one of our publishers and world-renowned artist, redesigned her costume to have pants. But it's not about the costumes for her. What I would say specifically about the current costume that Gal Gadot is going to wear is, you know, ultimately Wonder Woman comes from Greek mythology. And I think that the costume that she's wearing now, I personally think, really harkens to that in a very cool way and a non-exploitive way.
And you got her out of heels.
And we got her out of heels. Wedges are always easier. That's exactly right.
To mark 75 years of Wonder Woman, that was Diane Nelson, president of DC Entertainment, talking with our own Takeaway producer, Isabel Angel. Who's your real-life Wonder Woman?
Hi, this is Lynn Ray Pardo from Austin, Texas. Amy Schumer. She has the courage to use her platform as a truly professional and hysterically funny comedian. She frames the truth as both funny and poignant. She is my hero.
Well, here's my nomination.
The measure of any society is how it treats its women and girls.
Michelle Obama. Pretty safe, huh? But I have to nominate my wife, Allison, of course. We celebrate our 21st anniversary this weekend. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.